You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Former Governor Scott Walker says love of country and freedom are under attack, and he's got a 12-step plan to save those ideals for generations to come. That's ahead. Now, in a 4-3 decision yesterday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that Governor Evers went too far in restricting the capacity of bars and restaurants across the state. The court found the governor needed to get the approval of the legislature. This is the third decision from the justices limiting the governor's power to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. We want to hear from you. Are you concerned about our government's handling of the pandemic? Were the emergency orders too broad, or were they needed? Do you think Governor Evers could have done more to work with the legislature? Or do you think the governor should have more latitude? We're at 1-800-642-1234. We have with us Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief for WPR, who's been following the latest. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Molly. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you. So give us the latest on these capacity restrictions. What did the court say?
So the capacity restrictions never really had a chance to go into effect. I mean, this is something that the governor's administration, specifically the Department of Health Services, ordered back in October as Wisconsin was starting to see cases really start to climb and hospital capacities start to be tested. The capacity restrictions themselves would have limited bars and restaurants and some other indoor businesses to 25% of their usual capacity. They got taken to court relatively quickly. It bounced around between a couple circuit court judges, but they were struck down. I think what this really was here this week was a chance for the Supreme Court to weigh in on this particular type of order and the Evers administration's use of this particular law when it comes to dealing with the pandemic.
Right. So talk to us about Justice Brian Hagedorn and his rulings. What did we hear from him this time?
Yeah, so Justice Brian Hagedorn has become pretty much the swing justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I mean, he is a conservative. He has written opinions for the conservative majority on some high-profile cases, including the recent case that struck down Governor Tony Evers' statewide order that set up Wisconsin's mask mandate. But he has shown a willingness to buck the conservative majority. And I think noteworthy, last May, he sided with the Evers administration when the rest of the conservative Supreme Court struck down Wisconsin's much broader stay-at-home order or safer at home. So there was some thought that since that conservative majority had been trimmed from 5-2 to 4-3, this was a chance for Hagedorn to kind of have a do-over, you know?
Yeah.
But what he ended up doing is writing a very brief concurring opinion saying basically that the Evers administration, the DHS, had done again what the court had specifically said that they can't do in the Safer at Home ruling from last May. And Hagedorn said that while his issues with the court's ruling that first time around were well publicized, that because of his respect for the court and its authority, he had to uphold that earlier ruling. So, you know, in essence, while he didn't like the logic of that earlier ruling, it was the, you know, established ruling, kind of the law of the land when Evers' administration issued these latest restrictions. And Hagedorn said, you can't do that.
So basically, he said, I agreed with you the first time, but you kept doing it. And he didn't. He didn't side with the Evers administration this time, like you said. So what is this going to mean? What is this going to mean for the Evers administration and their ability to control the pandemic?
In theory, there is still a chance for Wisconsin to issue statewide emergency orders due to the pandemic. You know, In theory, this can happen. In theory, you could have another statewide mask mandate. In theory, you could have statewide capacity restrictions on bars and restaurants. But the common thread on all of these rulings is that the court has said that, you know, that the Evers administration needs to involve the legislature. So, like, safer at home or stay at home, the stay at home order, and you know, this latest order involving capacity restrictions, they both involved a law that spells out the authority of the Department of Health Services secretary. And what the court has said in both of those cases is that when the DHS secretary issues orders like this, they have to be promulgated as emergency rules. In other words, they have to go through the legislature, and the legislature has a chance to effectively veto them through the rulemaking process. When Evers issues his own orders, like he did with the mask mandate, the court said, okay, you get to do that for 60 days, but you don't get to reissue those orders. If you do, you need the legislature to buy in. And Governor Tony Evers and the Republican-controlled legislature do not see eye to eye on these types of orders. That's grown increasingly clear as the pandemic has gone on.
So what is this going to mean for the food aid deal that the Evers administration struck with the Biden administration? I mean, didn't we see another emergency declaration from DHS recently?
So that one is a little bit different. I mean, I guess I would say a lot different. So that one was kind of an emergency declaration in name only. I mean, essentially what the DHS secretary did in that case was Karen Timberlake directed her own department to do stuff that her department is already doing. You know, so the DHS secretary is already in charge of the Department of Health Services, and the Department of Health Services is already overseeing the state's vaccination efforts, is already overseeing contact tracing, is already overseeing testing efforts. And her declaration ordered the department to basically continue those roles. And through the deal that the Evers administration reached with the Biden administration said that would be enough to continue receiving. It's up to about $70 million a month in enhanced federal food aid. So without any kind of an order, that monthly funding was in jeopardy. But, you know, obviously the Biden administration is friendly with the Evers administration, and they were able to agree on this, and Wisconsin will continue to receive that funding.
So that wasn't seen as an expansion of their authority in the way that the other emergency declarations were.
No, just looking at the order, it looked like basically kind of restating what the department already does. And I can just tell you that when I reached out to spokespeople for Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu and asked them if they had any issues with it, if it broke the law, they did not respond. So I think given the adversarial relationship between those two and the governor, if they had felt that they went too far there, we'd probably be in court, you know,
yep.
But they seem to have let that one pass.
Well, let's bring another voice into this conversation to talk about what kind of precedent might be set here. We have Jeanine Geske with us, former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice, also a retired professor of law at Marquette University. Justice Geske, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Molly. My pleasure.
So, Justice, how much of an impact do you think this ruling will have on future administrations?
Well, it does have an impact. I think that particularly when we're dealing with emergencies, you know, the emergency here is a health emergency, a pandemic. But a lot of this authority in terms of the governor's ability to react to it and to put emergency orders in applies to a whole host of emergencies. And what's interesting is in the past, the legislature hasn't objected. They obviously, my view is that there's the partisan nature of the dispute on some of the orders and things, you know, got the legislature to bring Evers to court. They could have also simply revoked the emergency order. They have authority under the statute to do it, and they didn't. You know, and I always think when these kinds of things happen, it's interesting because down the road, you could certainly have the reverse being true with a Republican in the governor's office and a Democratic legislature, and suddenly everybody shifts their views on it. But it there are, you know, with these cases, at least for the time being, there's strong precedent that the governor's authority is very limited, not only to the 60 days and non extension, but it is also the Department of Health Services is limited in terms of forbidding gatherings and things for in health issues unless it's been partly authorized by the legislature.
Yes. And Sean Johnson, before we let you go, what are you keeping your eye on in terms of legislation in the next few weeks?
I think in the next few weeks, there have been some bills that lawmakers have advanced related to COVID-19. Again, these are things that the governor doesn't necessarily support. There had been some talk that they might try to override a governor's veto of an earlier COVID-19 bill that included some stuff that he liked, but also included provisions that would have, banned vaccine mandates by public or private employers and given the legislature's budget committee more power over federal funding. You know, beyond that, I think you're going to start to see lawmakers shift into budget mode here pretty intensely. And there's going to be a lot of talk over federal funding coming to Wisconsin due to the pandemic.
Budget season, another sign of spring. Well, Sean Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. And we do have Jeanine Geske, former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice, with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking with former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske. She's with us today to talk about the precedents being set with the latest state Supreme Court rulings limiting the governor's power to respond to the pandemic without the state legislature. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Do you want to see more bipartisan solutions to the pandemic? 1-800-642-1234. And Justice Geske, the phone lines are lighting up over here. There are so many folks that want to speak on this. Let's go next to Dave in Winter.
Here we go.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to say?
Just a second. I'd just like to say that I'd like to add in that local municipalities don't adhere to the governor's decision on mandates, mask or whatever, social distance or anything like that. It's just, and the local sheriffs and
right,
police force don't even bother to stand by those rules.
Right.
It's just, yeah.
It's so if you don't have enforcement, kind of what good is the law?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. It's like a free for all is what it's like.
Thanks for that call, Dave. Justice Geske, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, he's absolutely right. And the question is really, you know, it almost became advisory because there, you know, I don't know that there was enforcement, at least in terms of individuals complying with some of the orders. My understanding is there was enforcement on some of the establishments and the kinds of activities they had. And there were, you know, it may have been under municipal ordinances, but taverns got fined and so on. But, you know, it's really setting a standard for the state. And, you know, I don't think any of us really wanted police running around arresting people who had their mask pulled off. But, you know, to make a statewide statement that these health preventive actions are important for the health of our communities. And I think that's what the governor wanted to accomplish with it. But he's right. You know, they weren't certainly being enforced by law enforcement.
Right. So what do you think this means for the next administration? I mean, I was just scrolling through emergency declarations that past governors have made, and there can be many over the course of a year, whether it's propane shortages, tornadoes, flooding.
Well, and what's interesting is one of the arguments on one of the statutes is the governor can issue an emergency order for 60 days. And the question is, if there's another occurrence or event that happens related to that first incident, can he issue an order again? Because that's the theory on which Governor Evers proceeded to say, you know, the pandemic changed, the numbers went up, there was more danger. And the court has said you can't do that, that the legislature has to be involved after that 60-day period. You know, the problem I have here is that the legislature could have decided to cut off his order at any time and not taken him to court. But they chose instead to litigate this and take it up to the Supreme Court to set precedents, you know, for future governors and particularly, you know, to say that this governor had not complied with the law. And I think that's a shame. It shows that, you know, the relationship between the parties is really at an all-time low unfortunately, they're not able to work together for the benefit of the community.
But the law could be changed. I mean,
it could be changed. The legislature can change it. In theory, the court can, but it's less likely with several precedents there that's going to happen anytime soon. And that's what Justice Hagedorn was saying, is that there was just this case decided last year, and he didn't feel comfortable saying, well, I didn't like it, so I'm going to change it. But certainly a legislature could change the statute and change the provisions and give more authority to the governor or put other provisions in. You know, there's argument on the governor's side that, in fact, the law was pretty clear that he had the authority to do it. But now with court cases in place, he's not going to be able to do it unless the legislature consents.
Yes. Let's go to the phones now. We have Eli joining us from La Crosse. Hello, Eli.
Hi. I just want to say that, well, I think that Evers did overextend his authority. I think if he would have tried to involve the legislature early on, there would have been a better chance for a middle ground to be found. But the way that his relationship is with the legislature, once any amount of time passed and once they saw a chance to take him to court, that's what they did. I think the legislature could have done a lot more for the state. I think Evers could have tried to work with the 11th legislature a lot more. You know, I just wanted to make another comment. The other caller said sheriffs weren't enforcing that. A lot of rural Wisconsin counties have less than 12 sheriff's deputies total and have to cover dozens of townships and hundreds of square miles. So there's, even if they wanted to enforce it, they don't have the manpower.
Right.
No.
I know. I've driven by a number of bars and restaurants with full parking lots over the past year. Well, Justice Geske, I'd love to squeeze in one more call. With Cheryl next from Lodi. Hi, Cheryl.
Yes.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have been calling my representatives for a week and a half because of the food stamp benefit. And the legislative board has just decided not to work with this governor, and they were willing to take the $50 million of food share away from the most vulnerable people in Wisconsin, the disabled, the elderly, the very poor, and the and children, to make them, you know, just so that they could say, hey, we're better than the governor. They need to stop making these Republican, Democrat, and mask or not mask, and they need to realize that it was about food, and just like this other, the new mandate is about having the ability to stop this pandemic and stop making it Republican, Democrat. The legislative, absolutely, they're not even returning calls to their constituents because they won't call anybody that disagrees with them.
Cheryl, I think you are expressing the feeling of the majority of people, that they would just like people, the legislature and the governor's office and the government at the national level, to take care of the best interests and the health of people, and work together to do that. So,
yeah, thank you, Cheryl. Well, Justice Geske, what now? I mean, you mentioned relationships between the legislature and the governor being at rock bottom.
Now,
what now?
Well, I think that, you know, there's just going to have to be an effort on some of these issues. And I do think part of it is really calling on people to pay attention during their elections and who they're electing, and insisting with their legislators that in the governor's office that they work together. I think there has to be public pressure put on these branches of government, because this, you know, the stalemate that we have happening both nationally and statewide really interferes with the ability for government to do what it's supposed to do, and to balance those branches. So, I think we're going to continue to have disputes, but I do think the public has to make clear that that's not what they want.
Well, Jeanine Geske, before we let you go, I'm wondering your thoughts on the latest Chief Justice.
Yes, Pat Rogenczak just finished her term as Chief Justice, and Annette Ziegler has been elected Chief Justice. Annette's been on the court for some time and has a lot of experience. She's very conservative on her judicial views, but that in theory should not affect her work to oversee the courts. I'm very close to Ann Walsh Bradley, Justice Bradley, and I very much would have liked to see her as chief. She is the most senior member of the court, but that was not meant to be. And so, I'm hoping that Annette does a great job in trying to build the morale of the courts and to help to continue the courts as an important third branch in the government, and to let people know what the workings of the court is. So,
well, thank you, Justice Geske, for joining us.
You're welcome. It's great being with you.
Thank you. That was Jeanine Geske, former Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, retired law professor at Marquette University. Coming up on Central Time, Governor Walker joins us, 1-800-642-1234. Stay with us on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up on 1A, Neda Okorafor is an award-winning fantasy and science fiction writer for young people and adults. She talks to Jen White about her latest work. Plus, who saw and who ignored warnings about the Capitol insurrection? That's on 1A, coming up at 6. But now, more than 24 House Republicans are pushing a bill that would punish Major League Baseball for pulling out of this year's All-Star Game out of Atlanta because of Georgia's new election law. The measure would strip the league of antitrust protections, leaving it vulnerable to legal risks and altering its business deals. Other companies have also spoken out about Georgia's law, including Coca-Cola and Delta, saying it suppresses voters. But Republicans say Georgia's law protects the integrity of state elections. They insist that conservatives are simply being canceled. And that's the latest battle of what our next guest, former Republican governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, calls an ongoing fight to reclaim American institutions. And he's got a 12-step plan on how to do it. Are conservatives being canceled? Or are the voters and citizens speaking? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Where do you come down on Major League Baseball moving the All-Star Game? Do you feel like you can't express your personal opinions? How important is this issue to you? 1-800-642-1234. Scott Walker served 2 terms as Wisconsin's governor and is now the president of the Young Americans Foundation, a conservative outreach group for young Americans. Governor Walker, good afternoon. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So, first, baseball. What are your thoughts on the Major League Baseball move?
Well, I think they made a move based on not reading the legislation. I mean, the irony of ironies is the commissioner moved the Major League Baseball All-Star game from Atlanta, Georgia, where the new law passed requires identification and has a fixed amount of time for early voting, to Colorado, a state that has voter identification requirements and less time for early voting. So if this was all about the law, it seems a bit hypocritical, if not downright dishonest, that they'd move from one place to another, where if the argument's over the amount of time available or voterification, it's actually more stringent in Colorado. In fact, ironically, a lot of the politicians who were piping up at the time were people who are all for not just the All-Star game moving, but we're all for the DNC, the Democrat National Convention, being held in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Obviously, last year it was abbreviated because of COVID, but it was selected to hold the national convention, even though Wisconsin has a voter ID law. I know I signed it a decade ago, and has 14 days of early voting, which, as I recall from the Georgia law, is about three days less. So it just seemed to me to be a bit inconsistent. Overall, voter ID makes sense. I mean, we see it nationwide. Not only do Republican and independent voters support it, a majority in a number of the polls I've seen of even Democrat-identified voters think it makes sense. And in one of the polls just the other day, 69% of Black voters in America think it makes sense. We did it in Wisconsin. Critics said it would suppress the vote. It would reduce the amount of people voting. And we've consistently seen increases. In fact, last November, we saw about 75% of the eligible voters in the state of Wisconsin vote, which was about a 70-year high. So it just didn't pan out the way critics claimed it would. And I think that's similar to what you're seeing in Georgia.
Yeah. Last year certainly was a year for the record books. So Young America's Foundation has this plan, this long game, as you call it, to pitch conservative ideals to young people and college students. And I'm curious what your pitch is. This may, you know, people may see this or hear this and think, how is that going to work? What's your pitch to young people?
Well, overall is that we have a message that's uniform, whether you're young or old, rich or poor, Black or white, doesn't matter. As a conservative, our view is we want freedom and opportunity for everyone. Whether you were born here or you legally come here from somewhere else, freedom and opportunity should be available to everyone in this country. And it shouldn't be based on class or any other indicator out there. And we contrast that with much of what we see not only at our campuses, but even in culture and throughout society, which is the counter to that. And the left increasingly has become this agenda of pitting one group of Americans versus another, of saying if you don't agree with the radical dogma of the left, that there's any number of things that you'll be outcast as. Our view to counter that is to say, no, we believe in freedom. We believe in opportunity. We believe in everybody getting a fair shake to have their chance to live the American dream. And that doesn't change depending on what group we're talking to, whether it's young people, whether it's seniors or somebody in between. And so that's the overall argument. The long game itself is really a way to, excuse me, to get a chance, particularly in campuses and in schools across the country, and to a certain extent in culture and communications, to start to level the playing field that we see is significantly shifting over the last few years, where conservative students, conservative educators, conservative voices in general are being blocked from many of our campuses and many of our schools, not only in Wisconsin, but across every one of our 50 states in this country.
When do you pinpoint the change? When did you see this shift?
Well, you can see it over quite some time. This didn't happen overnight. This has been a change over decades. I know even when I was at Marquette University back years ago in the late 1980s, clearly there was amongst the faculty and staff there, as there were in other schools across the country, skewed more towards the left and the right. But you could still have a discussion. You could have a debate. There's still folks I know, professors I know, who clearly were not aligned with me politically, but I could have good debates and discussions with, as well as students. We saw into the 90s this whole emergence of political correctness, where there were certain things you could say or not talk about. But really in the last few years, I even saw it with both of my kids. I've got a 25 and a 26-year-old. The 26-year-old went to Marquette. The 25-year-old went to Wisconsin and Madison. You could see the change happening then. But really in the last few years, it's gotten to the point where I know the phrase has been used, but this cancel culture mentality, which is we increasingly see with students. We do polls nationwide, and a number of them showed nearly 80% of students who identify as being right of center to right, not just conservative, center right, say that they're afraid to talk about their beliefs on campus, not only for fear of getting a poor grade from a professor, but increasingly because of concerns even from fellow students and the pushback that they get, not just debating them, but outright going after them and any number of concerns that they've raised. So this is a real issue. It shows up again and again in the polling. It shows up anecdotally as well when we go on campus and talk to students. And it's something that even guys like Bill Maher from HBO with his show, he's obviously not a conservative. He's far from it, very liberal on most issues. But he himself and a handful of other self-described liberals have said, you know, cancel culture is not a good thing in America. People should have the ability to debate, particularly on a college campus. You know, free speech is guaranteed in the Constitution. It should be, and I think many of us believe, should be revered on our college campuses. And I know with my kids' case, I appreciated the fact that they, you know, they had liberal professors and they had liberals that they interacted with, because it allowed them to challenge their ideas. Now, both of them came out solid conservatives, but not everybody else is able to do that.
What effects did their college experience have on your sons?
Well, in their case, both of them, and that's part of the work that we do at Young America's Foundation, YAF.org, if people are interested, is let people like them, young people like them, know they're not alone. So part of it's reassuring and supporting people who already come to school as conservatives. Part of it's making the case by bringing, we're the largest group that brings speakers across the country and the campuses and a wide spectrum of different speakers. Part of it is to make the case to students who are undecided or maybe, you know, lean one way or the other, but are curious, as opposed to just those who are conservative. But in the case of both Matt and Alex, without a doubt, not just through groups like Young America's Foundation, but other groups on campus, being around people that shared their views on campuses where they felt largely overwhelmed from opposing viewpoints, allowed them to, you know, feel comfortable and yet still. I remember when Matt, there was a feature story on him in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel years ago. He was also involved in student government, and one of the people interviewed was the head of the College Democrats. He at the time was the head of the College Republicans. And they talked about how in the Student Senate, they got along fine, even though their political beliefs were different. So there's a way that you can respect people's beliefs, still, you know, be passionate about what you believe in and be respectful. But that's, unfortunately for a lot of our students, at least those who are moderate to conservative, that's something the polls show over and over again, that they feel threatened about, and we're just trying to level the playing field.
We're talking about freedom of speech with former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. He's now the president of Young America's Foundation. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about political correctness? 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about freedom of speech and cancel culture with former Republican Governor Scott Walker. He's now the president of Young America's Foundation. The group recently unveiled a 12-point plan called The Long Game, and their goal is to speak with college students, young people across America, and introduce them, as Governor Walker says, to conservative ideals. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. And Governor Walker, the phone lines are lit up. A lot of people wanting to talk to you. I want to ask, before we go to the phones, one thing that's on my mind, which is, is it not the free market to have people expressing their ideas? And if some people don't like other people's ideas, to speak up about it and say so, even if they do so kind of clumsily or...
Well, there's two different ways. I absolutely think In fact, whenever I've spoke, I've said I expected to be protesters, and there's every reason they can. That's the beauty of America. Even when I was governor, you can protest against your government without fear of retribution. So from that standpoint, absolutely. But there's a difference, and this is something we even articulated with lawmakers in regions years ago at the University of Wisconsin system, as well as what we're talking about now. There's a difference between making your case, being aggressive about it, even protesting or whatever, versus just shutting it down completely. To me, and we won. This is a case we won at the University of California, Berkeley, where they put up all these barriers, and ultimately we won because legally stopping people from speaking is a direct violation of free speech. Countering that, protesting it, that's all fine. But, for example, what we call a heckler's veto, if you go up on stage when someone's speaking and literally stop them at a college campus or anywhere else in society, but particularly on a college campus, if a group of people get up and bring in megaphones and stop them from speaking in an auditorium that's been reserved, that's followed all the rules and guidelines, and therefore people aren't able to hear that point of view, that's not someone expressing their opinion. That's someone violating someone else's free speech. And if the tables were turned, I'd be arguing the same thing, which is why I give credit to guys like Bill Maher, who doesn't in any way share the same political views that I do, but who understands that if you live in a free society, that means people still have a right to be heard.
Yes. Well, let's go to the phones and see what listeners have to say. Let's go to Willem in Colfax.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment. I think that what you're talking about is this sort of cancel culture and bullying and shouting down people is the personification of the leader of the Republican Party, Donald Trump. I think that's his whole methodology is to knock them out. I'll cover your legal fees and stand by and stand back and all that. And so I don't feel like, and as far as political correctness goes, to me, you know, we're charged to form a more perfect union. And I think part of that is being kind to people, not calling them names, not implying, you know, racial slurs and, right-wing ideologies, I think, should be shouted down because the world has seen some horrible things when the right takes control of governments.
All right, Willem, thank you for that call for Governor Walker. What do you say, Governor Walker, about the role that leaders play in setting the tone for political discourse in the country?
Well, I'd go back to the heart of the issue, which is instead of a lot of times when I hear people disagree, they pivot to an attack towards someone personally as opposed to saying, what's the subject matter here? In this case, the subject matter is discussions, discourse on a campus, in the public square, wherever it might be, and people having the right to speak about that issue. And if anything, I can think in modern time right now, some of the clearest examples of that are in socialist countries like Cuba, like Venezuela, where grand promises are made for power to the people, where instead you see power in the hands of a limited few. The people end up being oppressed. You see places like Venezuela go into adverse poverty and even malnutrition. You've seen oppression and the imprisonment of political opponents in places like the Soviet or like well the old Soviet Union, but now the Soviet or the socialist Cuba. In America, we don't have that. Whether it's Republican or Democrat, we shouldn't have that in our society. It shouldn't matter about the politics. The bottom line is that people should have the ability to speak out, particularly in places like college campuses, where you should be challenged. You should have different viewpoints. But to be challenged, that means that you can't just hear from one side. For all the talk of diversity, most of our colleges, and the data overwhelmingly shows this in survey after survey, the one few place where there isn't true diversity is thought, ideological diversity. Almost every major campus in America has a huge bias, particularly in the liberal arts, towards either universal or nearly universal faculty that only have one point of view, that only espouse one point of view. That's one thing. But when it goes into the point of people who have, again, even a moderate to conservative point of view and not even being able to speak out, that's where the problem exists. And I think fair-minded people, no matter what their political beliefs overall are, actually can see that and believe that that's a concern, because the table could be twisted and it shouldn't be in America. The playing field should be level when it comes to speech.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Rhinelander next. We have Rick joining us.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had a couple of comments. One is Governor Walker pointed out that the Major League Baseball had moved to Colorado, and he mentioned about the voting days in Colorado. What he failed to mention is every voter in Colorado is mailed a ballot. What he's talking about is open voting in person, and it is true that Colorado has fewer days. That's because mail-in voting is almost is universal, so it's not a fair comparison. But beyond that, the point I'd like to make is, and that the governor, I agree that there should be free speech, and I believe that at all viewpoints should be aired, and there should not be a stifling of that debate. But the reason that there has been a backlash against conservative speakers at college campuses is some of them have some very odious viewpoints. For instance, Richard Spencer is a racist and a conservative. And there are people who take offense when if they're black or Jewish and they hear anti-Semitic or racist rhetoric. Or if, imagine someone shows up like one of the Trump supporters at the January 6th insurrection with a Camp Auschwitz T-shirt and wants to express his views. I personally think that person should be allowed to express those views, but I just want to explain to the governor that the vast majority of people who protest that type of speech are offended by the message. And yeah, I believe he should be able to say that message, but it's offensive.
All right, Rick, thanks for that. Governor Walker, what do you say?
Yeah, okay, again, let's go to the heart of the matter. Those aren't the speakers we're bringing on campus. Someone like Art Laffer, 80-year-old Art Laffer, the person attributed to the famous Laffer curve. He was an economic advisor for Ronald Reagan. He's been around for generations. He actually worked with Jerry Brown when he ran for president of the United States in 1992 as a Democrat. When Jerry Brown proposed a flat tax, the once and former governor of California, Art Laffer is one of our speakers, and we have one of the campuses where they literally came in and did the heckler's veto and kept him from being able to speak on campus. There couldn't be a more kind, decent, wonderful human being that talks about economics than a guy like Dr. Art Laffer. So it really doesn't matter just into the details. We've seen it time and time and time again. So I'd be interested if someone like Rick believes that that's someone who should be shouted down. I think his argument was, to his credit, was free speech should be free speech even if we dislike it. Some of the comments that some people make, whether they're on the far right or the far left for that matter, are distasteful to most of us, and I'd have no problem pointing that out. But the speakers we're talking about aren't in that category. They're people with common sense, conservative ideas. People don't necessarily have to agree with them, but they're certainly within the mainstream discussion of political thought. And the fact that we've had campuses across the country that have blocked them from speaking really gets to the heart of the problem we're talking about.
All right, let's squeeze in. We are quickly running out of time, but let's squeeze in one more call. Steve from Sun Prairie, you're up next.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I went to a Tea Party rally during the Act 10 protest with my 6-year-old daughter at the time and watched them boo a 14-year-old girl that speaks. So this has been going on a long time. But I've raised my kids to be conservative. I show them the debt clock at least 3 to 4 times a year to show them what they're going to have to be paying. This is something that I'm hoping you guys can get out there to educate these kids on what is happening because of liberal and left-wing policies, how it's going to destroy their livelihoods in the future.
Thanks, Steve, for the call. Governor Walker.
Sure. Yeah, and the debt issue just alone on that, just literally talking about it, today, because that's an issue that really transcends party lines. It's $28 trillion. In fact, interest payments alone are greater today than the entire national debt was the year Ronald Reagan first took office. And so this is something, the average amount of debt that a person's going to inherit coming out of college is many, many times greater in terms of the national debt than it is in student loan debt. Student loan debt is a legitimate issue because colleges and universities have raised tuition about four times the rate of inflation, and that alone is a whole separate story for a whole other discussion.
So much here to talk about.
That's a big deal.
We could keep going for a long time. So much to talk about with you, but our time is short. In fact, it's out. Thank you so much for joining us today, Governor Walker.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Scott Walker there, the president of Young America's Foundation, former Republican governor of Wisconsin. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then several colleges around the state opted to cancel spring break this year to minimize COVID spread. We talked with a reporter about the impact that had on students. I'm Molly Stentz, and you're listening to Central Time.